Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Massive voter suppression of African-American people in the United States is in full gear. We will talk about how this system of disenfranchisement works. 5 years on from the NATO bombing campaign that overthrew Muammar Gaddafi, the United States is once again launching open-ended airstrikes in Libya, this time aimed at the so-called Islamic State or ISIL. What's next for Libya? The first meeting between a top U.S. military leader and Turkish authorities since the July 15th coup, but the media in Turkey says the U.S. military was behind the coup attempt. But first, we turn to racist voter suppression and disenfranchisement in the United States. There has been a deliberate and flagrant attempt in the southern United States to prevent African Americans from voting. New voter ID laws in numerous states, purged voter rolls, and tens of thousands of complaints indicate that voter suppression has already been a major issue in the 2016 electoral cycle. But is there a turnaround starting to emerge in these vast voter suppression efforts? We are joined from Washington, D.C. by Kristen Clark. She is president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
You have an article that appeared on August 1st in Ebony Magazine entitled "The Slow, Long-Awaited Turnaround in Voter Suppression." It's about the recent court rulings, I believe by an appellate court, regarding the state of North Carolina's amazing efforts, blatant efforts to suppress a voter turnout, especially from the black community. Talk about your article. Talk about the main point in your article.
Right. So North Carolina is perhaps ground zero when it comes to voter suppression in our country. North Carolina has made it more difficult to vote in every respect imaginable. They cut early voting. They eliminated roll-to-the-polls voting on Sunday. They eliminated pre-registration opportunities for 16 and 17-year-olds. They eliminated same-day registration. I mean, you name it, they did it. And a challenge was brought a few years ago to North Carolina's law. It is called the monster voter suppression law among those of us who work to defend access to the ballot box. And just last week, a three-judge court found that the law is discriminatory and found that it not only has a discriminatory effect on minority voters, but clearly was a law enacted with discriminatory purpose. One of the most remarkable parts of the ruling is a part that looks at the state's decision to cut early voting hours. The state received racial data that showed that there were many African Americans who availed themselves of the chance to turn out and vote early, and in fact did so at record numbers. And when they saw that racial data, that is what led to the decision to cut early voting. So the court found that the state operated with almost surgical precision to make it harder for minority voters to participate. It's a really, truly remarkable ruling that recognizes and acknowledges that there are states today all over our country that are dead set on making it harder for people to exercise the right to vote.
The United States, both parties, in fact, go around the world talking about and touting democracy as something very special about America. They wrap it up into the whole American exceptionalism narrative. But we had the Supreme Court itself, the Supreme Court, the highest court of the land, in 2013, do something that really significantly gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Shelby decision. Talk about that, if you would, Kristen, and also talk about why the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was such a historically significant event, perhaps along with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, perhaps the most far-reaching and progressive legislation that's ever been passed in the United States. Talk about that, if you would.
story. That's right. Bloody Sunday, Selma, Alabama. You have peaceful demonstrators marching in the streets in 1965, pushing for the right to vote, pushing for African Americans to be given the, you know, most precious right in our democracy, the right to vote. And as they were peacefully marching, they were met with brutality at the hands of police, who physically assaulted them with billy clubs and dogs and tear gas. Those searing images broadcast all over the globe is what led to Congress's passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And I think you frame it correctly. This is the most important and significant piece of legislation ever passed by our Congress. It's a law that has a lot of teeth, and it's a law that has done a tremendous amount of work to open up the doors of our democracy to everyone, including historically excluded groups such as African Americans. The heart of the Voting Rights Act is known as the Section 5 preclearance provision. That provision required that certain states with very long histories of voting discrimination first obtain federal review of any new voting law before it could be put in place. Through that preclearance process, which is in large part carried out by the Justice Department, there were hundreds of discriminatory voting laws that were blocked and many more that were discouraged. Everything from discriminatory redistricting plans to discriminatory decisions to move polling sites to hostile locations. Fast forward to 2013, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, issued a decision in Shelby County, Alabama v. Holder that rendered that provision of the Voting Rights Act null and void. It's interesting to think about the Voting Rights Act, its birthplace essentially being in Alabama, and Alabama also being the place that issued the death knell in the Voting Rights Act. It is a ruling that's really set us back, because now states do not have to go through that step of getting federal review for their voting changes. Instead, they are just racing forward with voting changes that we are seeing discriminate, you know, against minority voters at every turn. So the monster voter suppression law at issue in North Carolina is precisely the kind of law that likely would have been blocked if the Section 5 preclearance provision were in place. And because it was not in place, voters were subjected to that discriminatory law for the last few years, and we also had to sit out and wait for long, protracted litigation to play out to get to the victory line that we reached last week. But hard to undo the damage that unfolded while that law was in place. So it is a perfect illustration of the Section 5 preclearance provision and how it operates and how it really has been a safeguard to democracy in our country.
As a consequence, as you said, of the Selma March, of the massive civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, we had the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the section that you're mentioning where local and state entities could not implement new changes in voting regulations without having it reviewed by the federal government. As soon as the federal government steps back, as soon as it is removed, as soon as it does not have oversight, as happened with the Shelby decision in 2013, or again in 1876 when Northern troops left the South, you had a reversion to almost the same dynamic path towards the resegregation or super oppression or disenfranchisement of Black people. I mean, there's been a lot of change, but there's a lot that's the same.
That's right. We've made a lot of progress, and that can't be ignored. But what we've seen over the last 3 years shows that the progress is very fragile and at any moment could be unraveled. You know, the day that the court issued the ruling in the Shelby County case, that day, Texas announced that it was moving forward with a strict photo ID requirement for voters that had been blocked previously by the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act. So So before the ink was dry, we've seen steps race forward with voter suppression efforts that are really all about taking this country back, setting us back, taking us to an era where very few could participate and have a voice in our democracy. And, you know, it really is something that we should all be concerned about. 2 years ago in the 2014 midterm election cycle, roughly 36% of eligible Americans turned out to vote. That rate was the lowest turnout rate that we've seen in our country more than 70 years. And to me, that turnout rate is traceable to a lot of the voter suppression tactics that we have seen unfold since the Supreme Court's Shelby County decision. I want to live in a democracy where everybody can vote, and may the best man or woman win. And may those who compete for positions compete for everybody's votes. And I think that the folks who are using what's left of the Voting Rights Act are people who are committed to democracy and committed to tearing down voter suppression so that everybody has a voice and a seat at the table.
Kristen Clark, in an article earlier this week, a New York Times investigation found that in Sparta, Georgia, the majority white Hancock County Board of Elections and Registration was systematically questioning the registrations of more than 180 black Sparta, Georgia citizens, a fifth of the city's registered voters, by dispatching sheriff's deputies with summonses commanding them to appear in person to prove their residence or to lose their voting rights. I'm actually quoting now from the New York Times. Deputies going to the homes or to the workplaces of black residents in Sparta, Georgia, demanding that they prove that they are registered voters. Are the police frequently or historically used in voter suppression efforts?
Historically, yes. And what's playing out in Sparta smacks of the kind of stories that we heard about in our country in the 50s and in the early 60s before we had a Voting Rights Act. The police have a hand in voter suppression, a voter suppression that's playing out in the town of Sparta and in Hancock County. And, you know, we've talked a lot about voter suppression at the state level. And I think what we see in Sparta is a stark reminder that some of the ugliest of the suppression tactics that are unfolding around the country are happening in small local communities, places that are off the beaten path, places that are, not under the radar, places that you don't always see on the front page of a newspaper. These are the places where officials are really hoping to get away with some of the dirty tricks and tactics that they are undertaking to discourage voters from turning out and participation. What we're seeing in Sparta is a scheme designed to chill voter participation among African-American voters. So we are litigating and standing by those African Americans in Sparta who are citizens and want to exercise the right to vote like everybody else.
I want to go back, Kristen Clark, to the title of your article that appeared earlier in the week in Ebony Magazine, the slow, long-awaited turnaround in voter suppression. So we had the North Carolina voter suppression laws that had, as the court said, targeted black voters with surgical precision. That was deemed unconstitutional and overturned. But the slow turnaround isn't just in North Carolina. Talk about some of the other cases.
So Texas, we have to talk about Texas. I mentioned that the afternoon that the Supreme Court issued its ruling in the Shelby County case, they moved forward with a strict photo ID law. Texas's photo ID law was among the worst in the nation. This was a law that disenfranchised. At the time that it was adopted, there were 600,000 registered voters, people who had turned out to vote, you know, for years, who were disenfranchised because they couldn't meet the state's photo ID requirement. The photo ID law in Texas said you could only vote if you had if you have a driver's license or a passport. A conceal and carry permit qualified under Texas's scheme. A student ID did not. It was very clear who the law was intended to hurt. And, you know, they claim that these laws are needed for fraud, to prevent fraud, but there is no evidence that fraud exists. But what we do know for sure is that there were 600,000 people locked out. Just about a week and a half ago, a full panel of judges in the Fifth Circuit, now this is the most conservative federal appeals court in the country, the Fifth Circuit, a full panel of judges issued a ruling finding that Texas's photo ID law has a discriminatory effect on minority voters. So this is a remarkable ruling, but we got to remember that it took 3 years to get to this point, and that during those 3 years, there were, again, at least 600,000 voters who were locked out and many more who were discouraged from registering because they are poor folks. You know, folks who don't drive and don't get on planes and don't have a reason to have government photo ID in their possession.
Okay, Kristen Clark, in our last minute, let me ask you about what's going on in Virginia. Mass incarceration and voter disenfranchisement are closely related. The governor of Virginia, McAuliffe, made an executive ruling that more than 200,000 people who had been disenfranchised because of criminal convictions could vote. That's been overturned by the court. Talk about what the court did and what McAuliffe is trying to do. Is he sincere in his efforts?
Well, first, let me just say that it is shameful that we have close to 6 million citizens in our country. They are of age, they meet voting eligibility criteria in every respect and are disenfranchised merely because of a criminal conviction in their past. The governor did the right thing by taking action to restore voting rights to those folks in his state. We were disappointed to see a court issue a ruling about a week ago finding that the governor acted outside of his authority in issuing that order, restoring the right to vote to all 200,000 people who are disenfranchised in that state. But what the governor has now committed to do is committed to signing one by one individual orders restoring the right to vote to all 200,000 people. And I think that this is a demonstration of bold leadership on his part. He tried to do this the slightly easier way with a blanket order, but is now committed to going one by one until he restores the right to vote to all 200,000 people who are disenfranchised.
Kristen Clark, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined by Kristen Clark. She is the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We are joined from Toronto by Zafar Bangash. He is on the editorial board of Crescent International and is the founder of the Institute for Contemporary Islamic Thought. Welcome back, Zafar.
It's my pleasure, Brian.
In this segment, we're going to be talking about Libya and specifically about the fact that the United States has announced that it has begun launching airstrikes in Sirte, the hometown of Muammar Gaddafi, that ISIL took in 2015. Talk about the airstrikes. Were they something that we could have seen coming?
I think it was anticipated because the government, or one of the governments, there are so many of them in Libya, but the one that is based in Tripoli, which is called the Government of National Accord, it was established through an agreement on December the 17th of last year, and it's headed by a person by the name of Al-Sarraj, Faiz Al-Sarraj. There is a presidential council of 7 members and recognized by the UN as well as by a number of Western countries. But this government is based in Tripoli. That means in the west of the country, and it doesn't have control over the rest of the country, which means it doesn't have control in the east, where there is another government, or at least a strong man, General Khalifa Haftar, who has strong support in the Libyan National Army. And then the south, of course, is completely wide open. So this government of National Accord really did not have much control in the country as such. But it went after Sirte, where, of course, as you mentioned, it's the hometown of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. He was born there, and his tribe, the Gaddafi tribe, is one of the major tribes over there. There, these terrorist groups, ISIS or ISIL, etc., have been entrenched since 2015. Now, the government of al-Sarraj launched a campaign against ISIL or ISIS terrorists back in May. They haven't made much progress. And I think what the U.S. feared was that if this government that they have recognized that they are not able to take control or not able to defeat the ISIL terrorists, then this is going to create another problem in the region. I'm not quite sure exactly whether they are going to solve the problem, because one of the difficulties with these terrorist groups is that you attack them, and that provides, particularly if foreign forces attack them, they then use that as a source of legitimacy for their own actions. So while the U.S. has launched these campaigns, aerial attacks, they haven't said how long these are going to last. In fact, they appear to be open-ended. And if they are, then I'm sure that we can anticipate car bombings and other kinds of attacks occurring in different parts of Libya, and in particular in Tripoli, or where the ministers of the Government of National Accord are. So although one could say that we could anticipate the U.S. doing that, I think the end result is going to be very, very uncertain.
Right, because you can't really defeat your enemy or most enemies simply by an air war. You can do a lot of damage. You can blow things up. You can kill a lot of people. But you don't dislodge those forces from the ground that they hold. That requires a ground force. Is there a ground force available to oust ISIS from that area?
As far as foreign troops are concerned, there are no ground forces, except, of course, for a limited number of French special forces, although a number of Western governments are involved in Libya at the present time. These include the U.S., Britain, France, and Italy. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, three members of the French special forces were killed when their helicopter crashed. And ironically, the West, while on the one hand is claiming that it's supporting this government of national accord, at the same time, they're also providing aerial support to General Khalifa Haftar, who's based in Benghazi and who leads a rival government over there. And of course, the tribes in the East are not in favor of the government in Tripoli. I also want to point out that in his testimony before the U.S. Senate, General Thomas Waldhauser, who is the chairman of Africa Central Command, had in fact said that the present policy of the U.S. government of using only air power is not sufficient, and that ground forces would be needed. So it seems to me that the U.S. is actually preparing the ground for introducing its own ground forces. It's probably likely to be special forces backed by drones, etc. But that is the direction that I see developing if the U.S. continues with its attack on these terrorist groups. Now, although I have absolutely no sympathy with these terrorist groups, the concern that I have is that the policy that has been adopted to confront them is not likely to yield any results, as it hasn't in any of the other places where the U.S. and its so-called allies have been involved. And what is more likely is the way the scenario is evolving or developing is that these people, ISIS, ISIL group, etc., they will just simply go underground. They will also attract more people from other places, and then they will penetrate into Tripoli itself and start carrying out bombing campaigns, starting blowing up places, buildings, and even trying to carry out assassination attempts. For instance, they did against the interior minister in the government of national accord, although the interior minister escaped. But I think these kinds of attacks are likely to escalate. One other factor which I think is quite problematic is that nobody really knows how many people or how many members of ISIS or ISIL there are in Sirte. Some estimates say only 100, others say 1,000, and we have even read reports of at least 10,000 of them. Now, you know, this is a guessing game. You don't go around, military operations are not carried out on guessing games, and I think this is where the problems lie.
We are talking with Zafar Bangash. He's talking to us from Toronto. He is on the editorial board of Crescent International, and he is a founder, the founder of the Institute for Contemporary Islamic Thought. We're talking about Libya. Zafar Bangash, let me just keep going with the same discussion. The U.S. says they're going to begin and have begun the bombing in Sirte to defeat or to dislodge or to degrade ISIL. If the bombing doesn't succeed in defeating them, which both you and I are saying, and in fact the general who spoke before the U.S. Congress also agreed that bombing by itself won't defeat them, there is then the logic of escalation, because if the United States commits itself to the destruction or the bombing of ISIS and it doesn't succeed, then the logic is, okay, we must do something more. Now, in less than 6 months, President Obama will no longer be president. There will be a new president. Most likely, it will be Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was the chief cheerleader, the main voice, the main advocate for the bombing of Libya in 2011, and in October 2011, when Gaddafi was lynched, essentially, on the street, brutally murdered. He was the head of state. She laughingly said, "We came, we saw, he died." That was captured on video. I mean, odd, very unusual, I would say, in American or world politics for some sort of esteemed diplomat to be talking like that. But it was her policy. So if Obama is now has an open-ended bombing, and the open-ended bombing won't suppress ISIS, and Hillary Clinton will be the next president, it does seem to be the prescription, in fact, and perhaps a thought-through prescription for a continued advancing escalation where the United States could be in Libya for a very, very long time.
I think you are absolutely right. You put your finger on the crux of the matter. Hillary Clinton is the architect of the U.S. Libya disaster. It, in fact, also led to the murder of the U.S. ambassador on September the 11th of 2012 in Benghazi, in the U.S. consulate over there, and a number of other people died. And these were the people, the murderers, the terrorists, were in fact the ones that the U.S. government had backed in trying to overthrow the government of Colonel Gaddafi and leading to his lynching in October of 2011. In fact, Gaddafi had said prior to his overthrow that if he were overthrown, Libya would descend into chaos and nobody would be able to control it. Whether we like Gaddafi or not, I mean, he's dead now, but whether we liked his policies or not, the fact of the matter is that he kept Libya together, that he kept these groups in check, and that, in fact, he pursued a policy whereby he tried to provide benefits to his people. I can tell you, I've spoken to a number of Libyans, and though they were never supporters of Colonel Gaddafi, they now regret that he has been overthrown, because Libya has now descended into absolute chaos. There are warlords all over the place. There are, in fact, about 50 different groups or warlords that are operating in Libya, and they are not under anybody's control. Recent reports have suggested that, in fact, Colonel Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, who was incidentally sentenced to death last August, in August of 2015, he was released from prison in April of this year. And now a number of tribes are actually regrouping around him, sick and tired of the mayhem, the kidnappings, the killings, the bombings, etc. Particularly groups in the south are rallying around him, and they want to see him bring some kind of order to society. So I'd like to, I get the feeling that perhaps the U.S. campaign in Sirte is actually also an attempt to preempt Saif al-Islam Gaddafi from regrouping the various tribes in Libya and coming to power, because that would then undermine the U.S. and Western plan for Libya, and that is to install a puppet government in the country.
Zafar Bangash, one theory that's been held by numerous people who are in the anti-war movement, both in the United States and around the world, people who have been out in the streets protesting against the Iraq war, protesting against the Libya war, protesting against the U.S. determination to oust the Assad government, is that part of the plan with the United States, with all of these interventions, is not simply to create a passive regime, a client state, so to speak, but actually to fragment, to weaken these countries, that it plays to the strength of, or benefits Israel, benefits the United States. I personally believe that the fragmentation of these countries is more or less the unintended consequences of an imperial strategy that has been a catastrophe, of course, for the people in those countries, but also catastrophic in terms of the U.S.'s own plans. In other words, just based on small, feckless thinking. How do you see that?
Well, you see, this whole policy that the U.S. is pursuing was the one that was thrust upon successive U.S. administrations by the neocons. These Zionists who essentially wanted what they called was controlled chaos in these countries. And no less a person than General Wesley Clark actually confirmed in an interview with Democracy Now! On March the 7th of 2007, that a week after the attacks of 9/11, he had gone to the Pentagon, and one of the generals that used to work for him called him into his office and said, "Sir, I'd like you to see this." And General Wesley Clark said that he was shown a piece of paper that had been sent to him from Rumsfeld's office, who was upstairs in the Pentagon, in which seven countries were listed that the U.S. was going to attack, including, of course, starting with Iraq and then, you know, Libya and Lebanon and Syria, Yemen, etc., Sudan. All of these countries were included in that, and their ultimate destination, of course, was to destroy Iran. Now, we know, if you look at the list of countries that General Wesley Clark identified, several of them have already been so Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Somalia is in shambles, Sudan. And now you see that, you know, the chaos that's all around the place. So I think it seems to me that this was a policy, the U.S. policy all along, that they wanted to essentially totally destabilize these countries. And this was meant to give a free hand to the Zionist state of Israel. And even though the U.S. has not succeeded in Iraq, it has not succeeded in Syria, it has succeeded to some extent in Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen, although Yemen also, they're not very successful because the Saudis are so damn incompetent, they can't do anything, that this has created more problems for the U.S. than less. So their plan, of course, is not going according to script. Although I would say that the only thing that they have achieved is to create and or sow destruction. So most of these countries have become non-operational. It would take decades and hundreds of billions of dollars to rebuild Syria. The same applies to Iraq, which is essentially now not one country, but three countries. Yemen, again, is badly fragmented and divided. Sudan has already been divided. So you see that fragmentation has already taken place. Even Syria, they're talking about fragmenting Syria into different enclaves given to warlords. But I don't think that that is going to happen, because the Syrian people are much more sensible than any of the other people. But unfortunately, that chaos all around the region we can see, and that is naturally not to the benefit of the people at all. The only country that benefits from this is the Zionist state of Israel.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. We've been joined by Zafar Bangash. He is on the editorial board of Crescent International and is the founder of the Institute for Contemporary Islamic Thought in Toronto. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The first meeting between a U.S. military leader and Turkish authorities since the coup attempt has seen a softer tone from Ankara. But will relations return to normal? Tensions were inflamed after the attempted coup on July 15th, when Turkey demanded from the United States the extradition of Fethullah Gulen. We are joined from Turkey by journalist Kemal Okuyan. He is a regular contributor to Seoul newspaper. Welcome back, Kemal.
Hello, Brian.
On Monday, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joseph Dunford, met with the Turkish prime minister and other officials in Ankara. Is it back to business as usual between the United States and Turkey?
Well, actually, you see, the tensions between two countries has some history. So it did not start with the military coup attempt. And I don't think that it will be solved in a short time. We can say that this visit and other, you know, attempts to improve the relations are a bit trying to understand the position of each side. Because Erdogan has convinced himself and the society and his supporters that somehow the West has a link related with the military coup attempt. And on the contrary, United States and the other NATO countries, especially through the media, are trying to give the impression that there was not such a real military coup attempt, but rather Erdogan trying to use every means to strengthen his position inside the country. So there are two different positions, and this did not come out of nothing, because it has some story, some history. So both sides are trying to understand what the other side will try to do, because there is the relation of Turkey's relation with Russia. This is another problem for United States and other NATO countries. Events in Syria is speeding up. This is another problem, and there is a gap of policy of NATO in Syria now. They have lost their initiative. Maybe one reason is Turkey's the chaos in Turkey. So these are all the things that I think both sides try to understand how to cope with.
What's been the rhetoric, the tone in the Turkish media, the media that's controlled or allied with Erdogan's AK party, towards the United States in the week after the coup attempt? We see there are demonstrations. There was, I think there was a big demonstration at the Incirlik air base that the United States uses for its operations in Syria. But what's the media been like?
Well, actually, you have to take the note that the demonstration in Incirlik was not organized by the governing party, but a opposition Islamic party, which is more radical, and they do not support AKP. It's a smaller party.
What's the name of the party?
Saadet Partisi, which means the party for happiness. But this party is the original party that Erdogan came out. So they have some connection historically, but now they are a very small party. They are out of the parliament, but they have some militant core, especially among the fundamentalist part of the society. The demonstration was organized with that party. But to tell the truth, the Turkish authorities, and when we compare the rhetoric of the Turkish authorities with the media is much more harder against the West. So the Turkish authorities, except Erdogan, because Erdogan today attacked the Western leaders in a very interesting way in his speech. But other authorities are very trying to calm United States. For example, the visit of the chief of the military of United States, the negotiations were in a very, what we can say, friendly mood. Nobody tried to be hard on the other side. But media is not like that. In the media, there are a lot of stories that they have some connection. The leaders of the military corps had some connection with United States, Britain. Plus, some other Polish politicians, like the the mayor of Ankara, is directly accusing United States of orchestrating the military corps.
Okay, so that's playing itself out. If the government is mild in comparison, you're saying, to the media, which is taking a harder, more inflamed or inflaming position towards the United States or towards the...
I think that is the same for United States and Britain. The media is very hard on Erdogan, but officially, of course, they are more careful.
Yeah, very true. That's very true. But I understand the dynamic in the United States. In Turkey, just help the audience understand, is it more or less a division of labor, or does the media have its own life in terms of, you know, they're trying to sort of stimulate public opinion, stimulate headlines, sensationalize the news, or they have a particularized political agenda? Or is it Erdogan and the government is, okay, we're going to be formal, we'll be civil, we'll be sort of diplomatically correct, but allow the media to stimulate public opinion in a particular way?
Well, Brian, you know, in this world, in your country and in my country, we know the big media is has always some strong link with the administration plus big capital. So I think that it is a coordination of work, a division of labor. Of course, media has some more space to move. But what I think is, in Turkey, Erdogan is pushing the media to show the West that if you have some cards, we have some cards also. And I believe that Erdogan has some real evidence about the involvement of some high-level, you know, bureaucrats in United States or some other NATO countries involved in this attempt.
Kamal, let me ask you, so you believe the Erdogan government has evidence that the United States or certain officials within the United States establishment were in fact participants?
I believe that, and of course, on the opposite side, the others have also some evidence of, you know, Erdogan's manipulating this attempt. So it will be a real, real dirty fight. And of course, the aim of both sides is to compromise in the end, in the most beneficial position of each side. So this is a real bargaining, actually, but it might go out of control.
The United States cannot completely alienate or have a completely strained relations with whatever the sitting government is in Turkey, given the fact that Turkey constitutes the eastern flank of NATO. You can see that the shift and the change in the way Erdogan was greeted by the Obama administration at one time, not the last time he came, but the time before, he was treated with great honors. The last time he was essentially snubbed in Washington, they only met on the sidelines. It was very obvious that the Obama administration was upset with Erdogan. But whether it's a Democrat, whether it's a Republican, whether it's Hillary Clinton, who's likely the next president of the United States, even if there's strained relations with Turkey, they can't completely alienate whatever the Turkish government is. So the Turkish government, in fact, does have quite a few cards to play.
That's true. That's true. But the problem is Erdogan, as a personality, now, you know, has created a lot of mess throughout the years, inside, outside. For example, his way of dealing things today, he insulted the Italian government, saying that the Italians are trying to get my son, but because of some, you see, economic corruption. And he said that deal with your own mafia. And the Italian prime minister answered in a very hard way. This cannot go on like this. Two NATO countries arguing like small children in the streets. So Erdogan has completely lost the control. He cannot. He doesn't know diplomacy. He doesn't know how to handle things. I think that this cannot go on like that. So you are right saying that NATO or United States cannot, you know, get rid of Turkey as a country. The strategic importance, the economic relations are so high. But Erdogan himself is a real problem for United States, I think, because it is not easy to control him.
If the AK party, AKP, or the media are stimulating public opinion, or if public opinion whatever, believes that the United States and the West, which has treated Turkey chauvinistically in the past, so there's sensitivity on that issue, that they were also involved in the coup attempt. And if that public opinion becomes solidified against the United States and the West, do you believe that there will be some growing sentiment within Turkey that Turkey should actually leave NATO?
Well, there's a limit on this. Okay, in Turkey, people know about United States involving politics, military. History of Turkey. We had earlier successful military corps, and each of them had some tie connection with United States. Everybody knows this. But the limit is this. You see, this government has a support between 40% to 50% during the elections. The reason is economic stability. And the high portion of this social support know that if there is a problem with the West, not even a shift of the axis from NATO to, for example, Russia or Russian-Chinese axis. Not even that. But a real problem between United States and Turkey will create an economic crisis. So suddenly this sentiment, if things go so seriously, will turn against Erdogan. That's another problem for Erdogan. Because, you know, now we have a real middle class. During this AKP government, they had ruining the Turkish social sources. They managed to create a new middle class, so they can lose it.
Just help the audience understand, why would a pronounced crisis with the United States, for instance, cause an economic crisis?
Well, actually, you know, Turkey's economic relation is based on the West. Okay, we are importing a lot of energy from Russia, but the main real economic ties is with the West and mainly Germany. And of course, all people know that United States is involved in everything, the Turkish finance system, all the institutions. And now we realize that Turkish military was nearly controlled by people who became real U.S. agents. So people know how United States and other NATO countries exist in Turkey. So any change in this will mean that there will be some economic problem, and people are supporting Erdogan, not only because he is a religious man, or most of the supporters are, you know, getting some part of the paradise that created a very rich bourgeois class, new emerging bourgeois class. But ordinary people, some of them, had also some portion of this. And this is what we can say middle class. And middle class ideology is really strong in Turkey.
Kemal, okay, let's... So, thank you for that explanation. I want to go back to how people in Turkey also view the EU. Okay, we've been talking about NATO, but the EU has spurned Turkey's efforts to join the EU. It's made demands on Turkey. The German parliament a few months ago sort of passed a resolution acknowledging or recognizing the Armenian genocide. Things that would have been, you know, very inflammatory in terms of the, at least the non-Armenian population or political parties or the ruling parties in Turkey. But how is the EU viewed by the Turkish people?
Well, actually, the interest of the society, Turkish people, to European Union has decreased highly. You know, in the beginning of the 2000s, there was a real enthusiasm because everybody thought that being a member of European Union will increase, income and plus freedoms, democracy and such things. And we were the only, for example, some left forces were very small that opposed a membership process to European Union. I myself was also opposing that. But now, as the illusion about the European Union has collapsed in every mean, you know, I mean economically, related with the freedoms and other things. So people lost their interest. Plus, everybody knows that there will be no real membership, because European Union is playing with Turkey, played with Turkey for so many years. And Turkish government also is trying to force its own conditions to be a member, and which is impossible. So all sides and the Turkish people know that there will be no membership. So there's no interest to being a member of European Union.
Kamal, we have 90 seconds left. Let me ask you real quickly. Do you think that the U.S., the evidence of U.S. involvement or knowledge of the coup that took place or attempted coup on July 15th, do you think it reflected the American military high command? Was the Pentagon, quote, behind the coup, or was it certain parts of the Pentagon?
I think there are some parts involved. Because also, we know that we are following that the U.S. administration has some, you know, division within, especially related with the policy towards the Middle East. So the coup might not reflect the intention of the U.S. administration as a whole, but some part is involved for sure. For sure, because you see the relation of the coup with Fethullah Gulen is obvious, and Fethullah Gulen is living in United States. He has a great tie with Hillary Clinton, supporting her, financing her. He has close ties with CIA, so it is impossible that an old religious leader suddenly wakes up and says that I will try to have a military coup in Turkey. This is ridiculous. I think it is clear, but we don't know which part of the administration has been involved.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined from Turkey by journalist Kamal Okayan. He is a regular contributor to Seoul newspaper, but we are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.